Anyway, I think especially with this perturbative supersymmetry stuff, it's important to actually work out the problems for yourself. So the new homework is on the web, but I'm gonna write it down on the blackboard. I didn't print out because it's just one line. So it's do exercises. So we're gonna do exercises 1 and 5. Okay, so this is section 5, and it's page 35 from Weissenberger. So those are some exercises related to chiral superfields. So there will be this homework assignment. So this is homework 2. So this is homework number 2, and again, it's due in 2 weeks. So just so for you to have a rough idea, so once we are over with vector superfields, then we will have our last homework assignment, okay? So that one will be much longer, and so I don't know, I figured that, we can think after that whether we want to do projects or not, but I think 3 homework exercises, the third one will be we would need to do probably the most work for it. But then you will learn the supersymmetry, right? So, all right, so so very good. So any questions to me? No? Okay. So what we started discussing last time, and it has nothing to do with supersymmetry per se. So we started talking about effective field theories, right? So we talked about renormalization. And something that we haven't talked about, but what we will talk about effective field theories. And so what we discussed last time in particular is how we can extract different terms, different operators in the Lagrangian once we do an experiment, and we discussed how do we relate the correlation functions to scattering amplitudes and go the other way around. So we started looking at this very simple example, lambda naught is -1/2 del phi squared minus mu naught squared over 2 phi squared minus lambda naught 4 factorial pi to the fourth. So this is a simple scalar quantum field theory. So in particular, if we look at the four point correlation function, right? So if we amputate it, it will produce for us the quartic coupling vertex, right? But then what we discussed that there will be additional correction. There will be correction of this type, and then there will be corrections of this type. So there will be higher loop corrections, right? So there will be higher loop corrections to this correlation functions. So in particular, this one has additional power. So the whole this whole correlation function will scale as lambda naught squared. This one also has 2 quartic vertices. So this one will also be lambda naught squared. And so the problem that we pointed out is that once we start doing these higher loop corrections, we will get infinities. And so the way out, so direct computation leads to infinities. And so the way to deal with those infinities is to introduce counter terms to our Lagrangian. So this is a renormalized Lagrangian at one loop level. And so the idea is that we start with the original Lagrangian, and then we subtract counter terms at one loop level, counter terms. So you can think of this as we introduce additional vertices, in principle additional interactions, right? So we introduce additional vertices in such a way, and we tune the coefficients of those vertices, couplings, in such a way that the answers computed using this renormalized Lagrangian are finite. Okay, introduce additional vertices plus tune couplings to get finite results. And once we have done it at one loop level, we can continue doing it at two loop level and so on. And so ultimately, we will get a physical or renormalized Lagrangian, which is the one that we started with Bayer. And then we subtract counter terms, n equal 1 to infinity, delta L to the n. Right, so in principle, we need to implement this procedure to arbitrary high loop order, and in principle, or, you know, we should prove that it's possible to do it to arbitrary high loop order. And so naively, what happens is that this introduces infinitely many, in principle, can lead to infinitely many additional terms additional interactions in our Lagrangian, and then we lose, if this happens, we lose predictability. So we cannot do anything with our quantum field theory because it will require an infinite number of experiments in order to fix all this infinite set of couplings. And so there is a special subset of theories in all quantum field theories, which is known as renormalizable. Quantum field theories, right? So this is a subclass of all quantum field theories. And those are quantum field theories such that it's guaranteed that whatever the counter terms you have, they have exactly the same structure as the original terms you have in your Lagrangian. And so in particular, the theory, so renormalizable, okay, so counter terms contains operators already present in L naught, or a finite number of new operators. Okay, so in principle, it could happen that once you start introducing these counter terms, you will get an operator that you didn't have before. This is okay as long as the number of the operators that will arise during this procedure of dealing with infinities is finite. So in particular, the theory that I wrote on the blackboard there is a renormalizable theory. L naught is a Bayer Lagrangian for a renormalizable quantum field theory. And it's a highly non-trivial statement, but the statement is that all this infinite sum, right, so minus sum n equal to 1 to infinity delta nn, all this set of counter terms, I actually can write down because all of them contain only the structures that are already present. So I can write them down as z phi minus 1 divided by 2. So here I have minus del phi squared minus mu squared phi squared. Okay, so then I have minus lambda over 4 factorial that lambda. I guess I have to. No, everything's fine. Okay, phi to the fourth. And then I have plus delta mu squared over 2 z phi over phi squared. Okay, so it turns out that I can parameterize all this infinite set of counter terms. I can assemble them in the 3 operator, right? So you can see that there are constants. There is z phi. And then there is z lambda, and then there is delta mu squared. So in principle, those constants they depend on lambda, right? So they depend on mu naught, lambda naught, the bare parameters of your action. So if I'm going to call this guy delta L, so it's introduced in, minus sign. So all those constants are introduced in such a way, probably that L physical, which I'm going to be forming as L naught. So if I compare physical plus delta L must be equal to L naught. So if we do the algebra, we will find out that it takes this quality translates into this minus z phi mu squared of phi squared. Over 2 minus lambda, z lambda over 4 factorial phi to the fourth. So that's L physical plus delta L as written there. And so on the right hand side, I will have L naught. So I have my bare Lagrangian minus mu naught squared phi naught squared over 2 minus lambda naught phi naught. To the fourth over 4 factorial. So what I'm trying to do, I said that the structure of the counter terms is exactly the same as the structure already present in the Bell Lagrangian. So I parameterized my counter terms in this way. And then I want to see how the physical Lagrangian is related to the Bayer Lagrangian, right? So this is a physical Lagrangian, okay? Well, it's actually a physical plus counter terms, and that's, so this is L physical plus delta L, and this is our Bayer Lagrangian. So if you think what is happening is that we know that once we start doing quantum corrections with this Bayer Lagrangian, there will be an infinities. And the idea is to isolate those infinities and assemble all those infinities, think of them as coming just from a counter minus counter terms, so that whatever is left will produce a finite answer if we do quantum field theory. So this leads to this identity, and now you can see what's the relation between quantities that enter Bayer Lagrangian and the ones that enter physical Lagrangian. I actually have to tell you that I didn't write you down what L physical is. So the physical Lagrangian, because the structure is the same, I'm going to parameterize it in this way. Okay. And so now if we compare, so it is, you need to know that in order to come up to this line. And then you can see that the whole procedure of renormalization comes just to redefinition. What do we mean by a field and what do we mean by a coupling in case we have renormalizable Lagrangians. And so it takes this form. Okay, I guess I have to write it down. I don't want this to be lost. So we have that phi naught equals to that phi to the power of 1/2 phi. And then we have mu squared, mu naught squared equals mu squared minus delta mu squared, and lambda equals that lambda to the minus 1 that phi squared times lambda naught. So that phi is a wave function, is known as a wave function renormalization. Okay. And that lambda is a coupling constant renormalization. And then we have delta mu squared is a mass renormalization. Okay, so all these three parameters, they can be computed using perturbation theory to arbitrary order. Okay, and so the property, as you can see in this example, if the theory is renormalizable, so we started with a certain number of couplings, I prefer to think in terms of the number of operators that enter into your action, you don't change the number of operators. What you change is that what you thought were classical coupling will get rescaled and shifted, as in the case of mass, when you include quantum corrections. So it turns out that there is a simple rule which can be proven, which would allow us, somebody will give us a Lagrangian and we can figure out if the theory is renormalizable or not. So the question is, how do we know if Q of T is renormalizable? Well, let's look at the example we have right now. Yes. Del mu squared. Don't have a del mu squared. But because I missed that term, so there is a term here. So which will come from delta L? Where do I have delta L? And I have it still here. Right. Yeah. So there is this term z phi squared And so what they did, I made the piper here, and so here what you have is actually mu squared minus delta mu squared. Okay, so and I parameterized it in such a way that there is an explicit factor of that phi. Yeah, thank you. Right, so very good. So in classically we start with a potential, which is of this form, plus lambda naught over 4 factorial pi naught to the fourth. And so in this potential, there are two couplings, right? Two coefficients. So the potential has two operators, quadratic and quartic. And so so these operators come with couplings. So in this case, the couplings are mu squared over 2 and lambda naught over 4 factorial. And well, in general, what you have is that a potential will have an infinite series expansion, g to the n, pi naught to the n, right? So those are our couplings. So what we can do, there is a theorem that I'm not going to prove, and the theorem establishes that that our QFT is renormalizable. So I'm giving an example in case of a scalar-like Hill theory, but it can be extended to vector and spinor series, is renormalizable by power counting. If the dimension, mass dimension of all couplings, I'll explain in a second what it is, mass dimension of couplings, is non-negative. Okay? So if you start with a classical Lagrangian in which the mass dimension of all couplings is non-negative, then you are guaranteed that you will not generate by quantum corrections new operators. Okay? So how do we deal with these dimensions? So by mass dimension, I mean that my mass parameter has dimension plus 1. So I'm working in the units when the speed of light equal 1, h bar equal 1. So the dimension of x, mass dimension of coordinate equals to minus 1. Now mass dimension of the derivative del mu equals plus 1 because it's 1 divided by a coordinate. Now if I have an action, right, I'm exponentiating an action in order to write down a path integral for quantum field theory. So the dimension of the action must be equal to 0. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense to exponentiate it. So that tells me that the mass dimension of my Lagrangian must be equal to plus 4, because in order to get an action, I have to evaluate d4x over the Lagrangian. So now if I look at this term, so if I look at kinetic term, in my model, I can figure out what the dimension of my quantum field theory is, classical dimension, and everything that that I said there. Notice that it's related to a classical potential. So all the statements are the statements concerning a classical dimension of couplings. So those things can receive corrections, but as far as the theory, whether the theory is renormalizable or not, it's actually a statement about classical scaling dimensions. So if we look at the kinetic term, so I have del phi squared. So the dimension of this guy, I have two derivatives, so it's 2 plus twice the dimension of my field, and it must be equal to 4. because the Lagrangian must have a dimension 4. So that tells me that my scalar field have a mass dimension plus 1. And so you can see that mu naught is really a mass term. So my coupling mu naught will have a mass dimension plus 1. And the quartic coupling is actually dimensionless. It has a mass dimension 0. So in the model that we discussed, this condition is satisfied. And in fact, as I said, you can prove in general that as long as all the couplings you have in your theory have a positive mass dimension, then you are safe, and quantum corrections will not introduce any new operators to your theory. One thing I want to emphasize: this thing, which is very important, the way that all this counting really centered around how do we assign a dimension to a field phi. And the way how we assigned a dimension to a field phi, it was crucial to look at the kinetic term. I will come back to this problem later, but in fact, what we did now is the so-called kinetic scaling. Okay? So because when we talk about supersymmetric models and nonlinear sigma models, there will be a different way of assigning scaling dimensions, and it will have its physical reason why we will do that. But normally, when we do quantum field theory, so we use canonical kinetic term. Canonical kinetic term to assign scaling dimension. For a field phi.
Yes. I wanted to ask this earlier to you, but the sort of definition of every normalized field.
Right.
To me, this seems like a sufficient but not necessary definition of normalizability, because it relies on perturbation for the entire
definition. That's correct. That's correct. But so that's pretty much most of the stuff that we can do in quantum field theory, perturbation. Yeah.
Do you know of any theories that are known to be non or non normalizably?
Yes.
Sorry, not perturbatively normalizable, but not perturbatively.
Yes, there is an example. So there is an example of three dimensional theory in which according to this. You're absolutely right. So everywhere we have to add the word perturbatively renormalizable or non-renormalizable, and there are examples where we have a model which is not renormalizable by our counting, but is non-perturbatively renormalizable. Another example, of course, is
with
some additional coupling. Another example, of course, is a gravity, right? So what I will mention later is that so gravity is not renormalizable by power counting, but if we think about gravity as coming from a string theory, then we can make sense of infinities. Okay, but I'll mention that later. Let's see. One thing is let me go back to this issue, and then I'll ask again whether there are questions. So it's really crucial to have what I call a canonical kinetic term. For example, you might have a kinetic term of this type, okay, and then there is a potential via phi. And so you are asked, so if somebody gives me this quantum field theory, is this quantum field theory is renormalizable or not? So you cannot. What you have to do in order to implement the arguments, and what's implicit in the theorem that I mentioned, is that you have to make sense of the kinetic term. So this is not canonical. Kinetic term. And so you cannot directly apply power counting. In fact, things like that happen very often in inflationary models. So if you try to figure out what's the inflationary model that come, I'm of course more familiar with string theory constructions. So if you try to study scalar models of inflation coming from string theory, usually what will happen is that you will not get that nice kinetic term, 1/2 minus 1/2 del phi squared, but you get in principle some general function there. And so the question, if you want to now take this as a quantum field series and quantize and ask the question, will I get finite answers or not? And in particular, then look at this potential in order to answer that question, because potential encodes interactions. What you have to do, you have first to redefine. Redefine your field phi into 5/2 in such a way that the kinetic term is canonical. So what that means is that del phi hat should be equal in this case phi del phi. Okay, so I can solve this. So del phi hat equals to del 1/2 phi squared. So in fact, in order for me to ask the question whether this model has renormalizable or non-renormalizable interactions, the end, I have to ask this question not in terms of the original phi field, but I have to ask it in terms of the phi hat field, which is 1/2 phi squared. And so I can do what we did with lambda phi to the fourth theory, provided that I rewrite the potential now as a potential, so it's root of 2 phi hat, right? So just I'm solving phi in terms of phi hat, and it's given for this. So for example, if this potential contain interaction, I don't know, say lambda to the 8, phi to the 8, say over 8 factorial, okay? So if I would have a canonical kinetic term for that, so this interaction would be non-renormalizable with minus del phi squared kinetic term, when we would have a canonical kinetic term. But if the kinetic term, if we have a kinetic term of this type, okay, then we just argued that first we have to redefine a field in such a way that it has a kinetic term. Then this interaction becomes lambda to the 8 factorial, and then I have whatever, 2 squared times 5/2 to the fourth, right? And so now this interaction is renormalizable. Okay, so what I'm pointing out is that you have to be very careful how you address this question, because that's always implicit that you have a canonical kinetic term. And sometimes, I would say actually very often, this is not the case. And so so that will affect your conclusion as to whether the theory is renormalizable or not. So let's see. So any questions? Yes, please.
Question, I mean, maybe I made a mistake, but if I could repeat the whole story, like in, for example, 6 dimensions?
Yeah.
No, like kind of before, like just lambda 5 to the 4.
Yeah.
So if I do it like in higher dimensions, so then phi in the higher mass dimension?
Right. So in fact, so that's absolutely correct. So the renormalizability property depends on the dimensions, and I did not use the full theory of renormalization in arbitrary dimensions. So so everything that I'm talking about is 4 dimensions. Yes.
experts with generalizations than trivial? Or are there any loopholes?
No. You can do. So this follow-order invisibility has been cited and established in arbitrary gate dimensions. So you can generalize this theorem.
So then number 5 could fall to higher dimensions and not to normal aspect?
Sorry, 5?
Number 5 could fall.
I think, I don't remember exactly. We can look in the text. But there is additional terms there. What I'm trying to say is that there is additional contributions there, something maybe like D minus 4. So let's say it would vanish precisely for the
yeah.
And so in 6 dimensions, this condition will be different. But there is a similar condition that works for quantum field series in any dimensions.
Okay. Just 2 questions. In terms of the renormalizability, are you able to use 2 generic extra terms if you have not normalized
yes.
fractions? So there's no way to say
yes. So right. That's correct. So you will start doing quantum loop. Quantum corrections, and then again, if you wish to compute correlation functions, and you ask. Whatever the answer I get from this correlation function, can I represent it as a vortex in my Lagrangian, as an interaction vertex? So if your series is normalizable, you will get only the vertices that were already present. And you are guaranteed, as far as I know, that whenever you start with a non-normalizable theory, then you will get new vertices. And those new vertices will generate new vertices itself, and so there will be an infinite number of them.
Okay. And in terms of the proof for the power counting, does this use a dimensional regularization to prove it?
No. So if it were doing that, then I would not believe it. And I think any reasonable, if you are going to make a strong statement of the type that there is a you start with a classical set of operators. Think of renormalizability in these terms. You start with a set of operators. And you ask what are the quantum corrections. And so the statement is that pretty much what happens in the renormalizable series is that those operators that you started with will get rescaled. Okay, that's at a very naive level. So this is a very robust statement. And so if it were the case that statement will depend exactly how it makes sense with infinities, then you should not trust it. So in fact, the statement that I said, it doesn't rely on the way how you compute quantum corrections. It's just a statement on the classical scaling dimensions. So you start with the classical Lagrangian, you look at your couplings, and you ask, so this is also known as power counting, renormalizability. Power counting perturbative renormalizability of this field.
Can you give reference to the book more?
So the best discussions that I have is a book by Cheng and Li. So this is my favorite textbook on quantum field theory. It's at the very beginning, I guess it's, so the book is Chen and Li. I don't think, so they don't do exactly the proof of renormalizability. So in particular, it's very complicated because there are complicated divergences, there are nested divergences, but at least they give a reasonably self-contained discussion of that, and also reference to literature. Okay. And they actually do it here in arbitrary number of dimensions as well. And they look at the renormalizability of composite operators. So it's a really beautiful book. So the book is called Big Series of Particle Physics. It's very famous.
Last time I checked, it wasn't.
I have my own, so I did install it.
Just request a new one. Just request a new one. Yeah, we should.
No, if we seriously don't have it, then I think we should have a couple copies. So you guys can submit
physically training, and that's the complex. This is an it's difficult to read if you never seen the quantum field theory before, but it's a very good reference. So now, once I told you about the normalizable quantum field theory, what it is, let me give you an example of what theories are normalizable. So the theories that are normalizable is 5 to the 4th theory. So this is the one that we discussed. So all three theories are obviously renormalizable. There is no interaction, so if nothing interacts, they stay non-interacting. So all three theories. So if you wish, this is a list of theories for which we know how to make sense quantum mechanically, staying inside this theory without introducing any new ingredients. And then finally, gauge theories. So gauge theories, there are two types of gauge theories, abelian and non-abelian. So both of them, all gauge theories are normalizable. But then there are theories which, well, I guess more properly to discuss infrared free. So now what I'm trying to mumble is I try to give you an example of a consistent quantum field series that we know. Okay. So this one, again, at least perturbative. This one. So when we look at the gauge series, I said that they are all renormalizable. Okay. As long as we include. So if we have a matter in gauge series, and that matter has recovered properties that have masses, so that would lead to renormalizable series. So gauge series are divided into two groups. They are infrared free, and they are. There is one type of theories which are infrared free, and the other one, which is asymptotical free. So something that I will talk later more when we go into and discuss quantum gauge series, which will be after we study supersymmetric gauge series classically. I will be more specific and remind you exactly what infrared and asymptotically free means. But for now, remember I was saying that so if we look at the scattering vertex, right, the simplest one, and so this gives us a coupling minus y minus I lambda, and it was independent of the energy, so which means that if we ask for the experiment in which we have a scattering of two particles, two incoming and two outgoing particles, and we extract from the experiment the value of lambda, what I was telling you is that to leading order, it will be independent of energy, but in fact, this is not true. So in fact, once we start including interactions, and that's what we'll discuss much later, well, not much later, when we talk about quantum gauge series, is that couplings, in principle, depend on energy. This is what I already mentioned, that when you do a scattering experiment, you will extract, and if the results of that experiment you want to interpret in terms of a simple vertex, you will find out that those vertices, they're not numbers, if the theory is not conformal, but in fact, they depend on the energy. So they depend at which energy you did your scattering experiment. So the infrared free series are the series in which the coupling becomes small at low energies. Okay. So as the energy goes to zero, so it gets smaller and smaller, and in principle approach to a constant. Now, the theory asymptotically free, so gauge theory, so I guess I have to talk here about the Young-Mills coupling. So asymptotically free theory, the situation is opposite. So this coupling actually approaches to zero as energy goes to infinity. So notice there is a little bit asymmetry here. So here I said that the coupling can become finite, which is what we see in electromagnetism, okay? So later in the course, we will see what would have happened in our world if the electron would be massless. If the electron would be massless, the fine structure constant will not be 1 over 137, but it will be 0 at long scales. So, but what I want to say here is that this series in which the coupling gets small as we go to low energies, the coupling actually goes to plus infinity as energy approach some finite energy known as, if you wish, land up Paul energy. So we'll see formulas later in the course. And so what this tells us is that even though the theory is renormalizable, and I should think of it as making sense at any energies, in fact, I cannot make sense of infrared free theories as a quantum field series at energies above the Landau pole. So this is somewhat something that people, so this is opposite to what we discussed before. If the theory is non-renormalizable perturbatively, can it be renormalizable non-perturbatively? So here we have an example when the theory is perfectly well-defined perturbatively, but as a quantum field theory, as a standalone quantum field theory, it doesn't make sense. Okay, so their renormalizability is not necessarily a condition for theory to exist as a consistent quantum field theory. An example of infrared free theory is electromagnetism. So electromagnetism is an example of a gauge theory which is infrared free, and so it has a Landau pole, and so that's one of the reasons that there is no way but we expect additional physics beyond the standard model. In fact, any quantum field theory which has a U1 gauge groups is inconsistent from this perspective as a quantum field theory. So that's why people try to invent grand unified field series, a series in which this U1 gauge groups appear as subgroups when a grand unified gauge group is broken by Higgs magnet. All right, good. So we talked about renormalizable field series, but then there are, as you might have imagined, there is a huge class of non-renormalizable quantum field series. So let's see, there is. So non-renormalizable. Quantum field theory. So an example of non-renormalizable quantum field theory is a phi to the n quantum field theory if n is larger than 4. So again, I'm talking everything that I'm saying in d equal 4 space-time dimensions. So that's one example. A second example of a theory which doesn't make sense as a quantum field theory per se is gravity. So by gravity, what I mean an Einstein gravity. So I mean a model in which the action takes this form. So it's root g r, and then I have in front of it, so the action is 1 over 16 pi g Newton, and 8 pi g Newton equals m Planck minus 2. So this is Einstein gravity.
Okay. So in which sense, how you should think about non-renormalizability about gravity? Well, we first need to quantize it, right? So what we are doing when we are quantizing the theory, we're assuming that there are some small fluctuations around certain background, okay? So in some sense, the quantization is never background independent. So we need to choose, that's at least that's the only way how I know how I would quantize. I would choose a background and I will study there around that background, assuming that the background is consistent. So sort of study a vacuum of the theory, choose a vacuum of the theory, and in that vacuum, I study fluctuation. If I choose a different vacuum of the theory, the spectrum of fluctuations will be different. Okay, and I would need to quantize those fluctuations in a different vacuum. So the way how we can do this in gravity is, so the gravity has a metric tensor, g mu nu. And so the way how we can think about the background in Einstein gravity is, well, for one reason is, we'll talk later, maybe today, maybe next time, about more complicated vacua. But in some sense that in the Einstein gravity, you try to guess what's the simplest vacuum. So that's where you might say, okay, things go wrong because you made a wrong guess about which you are trying to study the fluctuations. But normally, the guess that we are doing, and again, this guess, if you wish, is motivated by the real world in which we live, which tells us that we live in a flat, almost flat space-time. Right? So this is a Minkowski metric. So this is Minkowski metric. So eta mu nu equals minus 1, 1, 1, 1. Okay? And so again, this appeared to be, if we want to think about gravity as a quantum field theory, this appears to be very natural and coming from real world. And so what we do, we want to say that our metric is Minkowski background plus small fluctuation. Okay, and this small fluctuation, is analog, if you wish, of the field phi. Okay. Right. So is that clear? Is that clear there, what I'm doing at this stage? Yes?
I don't want to distract you very much, but you said that this is a natural thing to do from Einstein's gravity. I would say that it's not, because even if you believe in GR and background dependence, and that's an important thing, that this is not natural at all. It's not as gravity as well.
Right, but that's what I don't believe.
Yeah.
Because, and I know all my examples that I am familiar in quantum field theory, they're actually different. Because I can take a quantum field theory in which, for example, some two-dimensional quantum field theory which I can solve exactly. And I know that how do I quantize the theory will depend on where do I do this quantization. And later, maybe at the very end of the course when we have time, and when we study supersymmetric models, exactly solvable, again, supersymmetric H series, then where I quantize, the theory will have a moduli space of vacuum, something that I was mentioning before, and where I quantize the theory, at which point of the vacuum I choose, I will get different spectrum fluctuations. So from this perspective, it's what I said. I don't know how to quantize it, except that what you want to say that in gravity, if I do quantum gravity, I would be integrating over all metrics. And so metric is not sort of an observable to which I cannot say anything because we haven't observed the gravitational waves yet, but everybody believes and people spend tons of money on that. So if you can So what you can think of is that this h mu nu is a gravitational wave. So in some sense,
So it can be a lot of discussion. So, but it, I don't want to cut you because this is a very interesting point.
Yeah, I think that it's important also to say that there are other approaches to doing this that are not attributed that have this existence.
That
I'm not sure, but for two reasons. One reason is that I'm not very familiar with them. Second is that, again, my intuition comes as an effective. By the way, you will see that that's not a big deal. You know, up to now, everything that I presented, you might develop an impression that, okay, if the series is non-normalizable, then we are doomed. But that's not the case. And that's what I'm going to talk later today when I talk about effective field theory. So if everything is well-defined, it makes sense of what is that. But, so what I'm saying is that this is not a quantum gravity force. This is a force on quantum field theory. What I'm saying is that if I try to use my quantum field theory intuition to gravity, then this is what I have to do. And I will tell you in a second what will happen. Just a question.
Well, not a question of coming. I thought there are other forms, like question of other field theories, kind of which are. Which you can make sense of in the non-perturbed regime for perturbed. I mean, that's like...
Right, that I said yes. Yes. So that becomes a choice. Maybe you are expanding around the wrong vector. I choose, if you wish, a vacuum corresponding to Minkowski metric. And maybe that's the case. And some people, indeed, if you look at the FTH archive, you will find out papers where people talk about a fixed point. Since I haven't explained what the fixed point is to some of the people, it might be just an empty jargon. But anyway, what you're saying is possible. On the other hand, if I want to do the real world, if I want to do the gravity that I observe, then what I see is that the space is almost flat. And then what I'm saying is, I don't know string theory at all, so let me just try, and I just want to look at the Einstein gravity. I know that I have a huge success with quantum field theory, so let me use the rules of quantum field theory and see what will happen. And then, once I say this, then I have no other choice by trying to expand around Minkowski vector. Because to a huge level of precision that, again, my quantum field theory tells me that we have Lorentz symmetry, right? And so to a leading approximation, when we look at the scattering experiment, our quantum field theory are Lorentz invariant, to a leading approximation, I would like to choose a metric which would preserve that symmetry. Very good. So let's see what will happen. I still didn't explain you what will happen if you do that. We all started arguing why this is a bad thing, but, you know, does somebody know what will happen if we do that? Yeah, but why?
That's particular mass.
No, but we don't know that, right? So I'm saying all I have to do is I just did this, and... I'm just saying at the level, at the computational level, what will happen? Okay. Actually, I'm sure that if each of you will, this could be a good exercise, right? But let me give you the answer, what will happen. So what will happen is that this H will have a kinetic term, but that kinetic term will not be canonical, okay? This kinetic term will not be canonical. So what you would have to do, you would have to rescale H the way how I explained you, and write down a canonical kinetic term. And then, actually, there will be... an infinite number of interaction vortices. And the reason for that is that Ricci scalar is not, it's a nonlinear. So the Einstein Hilbert is nonlinear. And so there will be, because of that, there will be an infinite set of vertices. And now, if you have an infinite set of interactions, if you start renormalizing this theory, those vertices will produce you new operators. And again, this is something that people did before, and so this is an established fact. So there will be, for example, cubic vertices, and with, well, force for the vertices and so on, with derivatives as well. So those will be non-renormalizable interactions like power counting. And once you try to quantize the theory and you ask, what new operators will they produce? And so what you will find out, that you started with, so you compute a correlation correlation functions, including loop corrections, and you want to interpret it as additional vertices in your Lagrangian. So you will ask, what additional operators will be generated here? But what you will find out is that there will be an R squared. But in order for this to make sense, what will happen is that this operator must be suppressed by M Planck squared in order to have the right unit, right? So remember that Ricci scalar has two derivatives of the metric. Metric is dimensionless. So Ricci scalar, the metric dimensionality, so the mass dimension of Ricci scalar is +2. So in order for that guy to have the same units as R, the dimension of R must be +2. I must have M Planck squared here. It will come up with some number. Then there is some number, R cubed, so M Planck to the fourth, some number, R to the fourth, M Planck to the sixth, and so on. So what will happen is that if we do the naive, straightforward quantum field theory renormalization of gravity, there will be an infinite set of corrections. And so, so much like in any non-renormalizable quantum field theory. So the thing is that if we do string theory, this structure actually appears naturally. So it doesn't, but again, let me give you an analogy with quantum field theory, something that I already mentioned to you. So I said that if we look at a lambda phi to the fourth field theory, and suppose that we forget to include the master, okay? So what I told you is that the mass term will be generated. Okay? So in other words, you try to omit some operators, and the statement is that quantum corrections will generate this term, whether you like it or not. So the same thing happens with Einstein-Hilbert term. If you use the rules of quantum field theory and you pretty much say, okay, I'm going to put all these coefficients to zero so that for some reason I'm going to do what Einstein did. I just want to do Einstein gravity and nothing else. But the thing is that even though you started with all those coefficients being zero, they will become non-zero once you put quantum correction. Much like here, there will be a mass term generated by quantum correction. The problem, the difference is, because in this case it is only the mass term that is being generated and nothing else. And you have a well-defined quantum field theory. In this case, you will not. There will be an infinite set of operators that is generated. Now, because I told you that there is an infinite set of operators that is being generated, you need an infinite set of experiments in order to fix these corrections. Now, I told you before that a U1 theory has a problem, and the way to handle that theory is to embed it into a larger theory. Think of electricity and magnetism as a part of a larger theory,
and make that larger theory self-consistent quantum mechanically. So one way to handle this problem is to not think about gravity as a standalone, but embed it into a larger consistent quantum field theory. And by consistent quantum field theory, I mean consistent quantum field theory with the rules of quantization that we discussed. So once we change those rules, we can get something different. But that's not what I'm willing to do. I want to use the quantization rules that were so successful in experiments, and I'm going to do that. And then that will lead to a string theory. So if we now use a string theory, then the string theory will automatically predict that there will be an infinite set of corrections. Moreover, it will allow us to compute those terms. For example, if we look at type 2b, the so-called type 2b string theory, then this number, you actually can show that those two numbers vanish. They are not there. And that number takes a particular form. I don't remember it exactly, but it's something that's proportional to a zeta function at 3 times some rational number. So my point is that the non-renormalizable theories you will get if you embed it into larger, well-defined theory will produce you infinite set of operators, but there will not be an infinite set. You can still you don't need an infinite set of experiments to fix all parameters, because this higher, bigger theory has a finite set of numbers, ideally. Which in the case of a string theory is a problem, is problematic, because string theory has an infinite set of vacuum. But that's a different type of story. All right, guys. So I told you about non-renormalizable theories. And so the question is, how can we live with them? So it looks like that there is no choice. We need to live with them. So the answer to this, the question is, how do we live? Do we live with non-renormalizable quantum field theories? And the answer to that question is effective field theory. So what I'm going to do now is to explain you a very powerful concept of effective field theory. So again, the idea is simplest to explain, starting first with renormalizable theory. So effective field theory is a universal thing. I can use it for renormalizable and non-renormalizable theories. But it will be more intuitive if we go back to renormalizable quantum field theories first. And then I will just tell you what will happen, and it will be more or less obvious once we look into a non-renormalizable series. Well, if we go back to renormalizable, okay. So remember that in order to find an efficient way to compute a correlation function, we introduced a generating functional that was generating functional for correlation functions. And the way we do that, so what we did in a pass integral, by the way, if the theory is renormalizable, then the pass integral has a well-defined meaning, and it doesn't have a well-defined meaning in the case of non-renormalizable theories. That's why I need to use renormalizable theories in order to introduce the notion of the effective field theory through the pass integral, as I want to do. So the pass integral has e to the is, and then there is an additional source term, g of x phi of x, d4x. So suppose if the theory is renormalizable, this pass integral has a well-defined meaning. And so I'm gonna write down this integral as w of j. Okay, so this is some functional. So w is some functional those of you who know statistical mechanics, if you look at this, you will immediately identify this W as a free energy. So this is the analog of the free energy in the context of quantum field theory. And so you can see the relation IW pretty much is defined as logarithm of the partition function in the presence of a source term. So in fact, we know what this W is, right? Well, we don't know, but we know what's a good approximation, right? So the thing is that if we have this path integral is dominated in a stationary phase approximation by a classical trajectory, right? Remember we discussed this before. If we have a path integral, then the leading contribution from this path integral, so I have to finish writing, is dominated in a stationary phase approximation by a classical trajectory. So the classical trajectory is determined as delta over del phi classical as a function of f. So we evaluate this variation, okay? We solve for it when phi of x equals phi classical of x. So that will determine, that will be a stationary phase approximation in a path integral, and that will give me classical trajectory. And then this path integral, that of j, will be to leading order is just e to the I s evaluated by classical of x, right, plus integral j of x by classical of x. Okay, so this is something that we discussed before. Now, of course, whatever phi classical I get here, right, so phi classical will be just a functional of the source, right? So it will depend what source do I have, and so the combination here is actually a functional of the source. So in a stationary phase approximation, IW of J is approximately S of phi classical, which depends on J, and then plus an integral J of X phi classical, which depends on J d phi X. Oh, sorry, I have to remove I here. So this is in the case if we were to do an approximation. However, what I can do, I can say, well, I can do approximation and then I can compute corrections to this approximation. But suppose I don't want to do that. Okay? Suppose what I want to do, I want to say that E, so notice that, notice this structure. So this structure is correct only to leading order. And so when I do this structure, this phi classical have a very specific meaning. There is a very specific computational procedure, how you find it. And then this action, S, is the original action that you started with. But what I can do the following. I'm going to say that the exact W of J, so now I'm not doing an approximation, so this is an exact equality, and I'm going to say that this is equal to S effective as a function of phi, phi classical. Okay, so now I will confuse you completely, but still let me do that. D for x, g of x, phi classical of x. Okay, so now I'm saying that whatever the answer here is, I'm just going to write it down in this way. So there is some S effective as a function of phi classical plus a coupling to the source. Once I did that, then, of course, S effective is no longer equal to the action. It can be something completely different, something unrelated. And then what I call phi classical, and this is where I am afraid I will introduce some confusion, has nothing to do with phi in path integral. Okay? So you can say, all right, so you made things so arbitrary, so how can we make sense of this all? And so you didn't tell us what this S effective is, and you didn't tell us what phi classical is. So what are you talking about? In fact, all what I wrote is very well defined, there is a unique procedure. How do you compute effective action, and how do you compute the field phi that enters there? Okay, how about we want to do that, and instead of classical here, we will put a hat, so we will not show some phi hat. Okay, I think I'll be more happy with this. So the argument goes as follows. So we assumed that theory is renormalizable, and that told us that in principle, in practice, it's impossible, but in principle, we should be able to compute a path integral. Now, if I am able to compute a path integral, then in principle, I am able to compute W, right? Because W is minus I ln of the path integral in the presence of a source. So in principle, uniquely defined. So if it is uniquely defined, then what I can do, I can compute a variation in the derivative on the left-hand side, and now I can compute a variation derivative on the right-hand side, okay? I said by definition, right? So what I said here is by definition, I'm introducing my effective action and phi hat in such a way that those two things are equivalent, and what I'm doing now is computing a functional derivative on both sides. On the left-hand side, I have del W over del J, and on the right-hand side, I will just have phi hat of x, right? The reason for that is because S effective of phi hat does not depend on the source. The only place the source enters is in the second term. So you can see that this formula gives me the definition. What do I mean by phi hat? If I can compute a functional integral exactly, there is an unambiguous way what is that corresponding phi hat is. Now, once I know what phi hat is, I know what S effective is. So S effective is W of J, and what I have to do, I just have to subtract J of X times phi hat of X, but I know what phi hat of X is. This is del W over del J. So again, it's uniquely defined. Uniquely and unambiguously defined. All I need to do is I'm using the assumption that I can compute that path integral exactly. Then that tells me what effective action is. But the last step is what I can do, I can look at this relation. On the left-hand side is a functional of j, and here is a function of phi. So I can invert it. I can invert it and say that j of x is whatever j that depends on phi hat of x, some function. Again, formally, I can invert it. And then, so as defined here, S effective depends on J, but now my S effective, which is S effective of J, becomes S effective of J as a functional phi hat. So I told you that's what I call effective action, okay? This is effective action. And that's a very rigorous way of defining effective action in a context of renormalizable series. Each step is well defined and justified, and at least perturbatively can be computed to arbitrary precision. So let's see where we are now. OK, very good. So if you think what is happening in this, what physically happening, so those are mathematical manipulations, but you also have to have a physical idea what is happening. So there is a complicated quantum field theory, okay? And that quantum field theory has a path integral. So what we are doing here is saying whatever the complicated quantum dynamics happened in this quantum field theory, I'm going to mimic it by a classical dynamics in the effective field theory. Okay, so this is a very, very powerful statement, is that complicated dynamics in quantum field theory, so it becomes exact to a classical dynamics in effective field theory. Right? So this is a way how we make a complicated quantum problem a classical problem. Of course, there is still the, I'm not really solving the problem, because when I do all these steps that I emphasized here, I need to actually solve the quantum field theory, okay? And the only way we know, we can do it order by order in the perturbation theory. What this tells us is that it's very complicated to do this. So it's very difficult, but not impossible. And in fact, the way how usually people do it, so you do it order by order in perturbation theory. And so the way how this effective field theory is being presented, so again, this is a classical theory, so it doesn't make sense to quantize it anymore, okay? Because again, it arose from the so it's a classical description of a quantum dynamics, so it does not make sense. Somehow it already knows about all quantum corrections, but it will have an infinite number of terms, because again, all the quantum field theory is going to be encoded secretly in this effective action. And so what people do here, this equality sign, is what's known as derivative expansion. So which means that they organize different terms in this quantum field theory by the number of derivatives. Yes, because what this means is that if you have, say, two fields, a scalar and a spinor, then you would need two sources
right? One source that couples to a scale and the other source that will couple to a scale.
But that is, we have two fields and two jets on the input, right? I mean, there are non-parametric solutions, like in some form.
Right, so
in that case, from the beginning, we do not have many fields.
That's correct. So everything that I'm talking is perturbative, renormalizability, perturbative effect. So I'm not talking about non-perturbative corrections and instant ones and things like that.
But this setup is non-part of the definition.
In principle, yes. In principle, yes. But in practice, when I start making the steps, i.e. computing this past interval, I can do it perturbatively.
Yes.
And I can do all the other steps, for example, computing that functional derivative, inverting the source in terms of the phi hat. I can also do it only perturbative in interactions. Mm-hmm. So I can do it exactly for free field theory, mm-hmm. and then I can do it perturbatively in interactions. So I don't know how to do it non-perturbative in principle, and I'm not sure. Well, I would say I'm sure that you cannot do it non-perturbatively in general. So I'm just going to do that, and we will end up. So the first term is a potential term. It doesn't contain any derivatives. And then there is a two-derivative term, del 2 phi hat squared. And then it's multiplied by z of phi hat plus terms that has four derivatives, okay? Plus four derivative terms, and so on. Okay? So what I told you is a derivative expansion of the effective action. And we will try to discuss next time for which question this is useful. And then what you will end up doing is you will end up computing to perturbation theory these quantities. And there is a well-established procedure how you do it. All right, guys, see you on Thursday.